I want to begin by showing you that picture. You've got the title of my sermon already. An old black and white photograph. The place was northeastern Persia, or as it's often referred to, Iran. The name got changed in the 20th century. The date was March 19th, 1839, according to most historical accounts. This was, if I've got my calculations right, the third day of the month Nisan, 11 days prior to the Passover. Something happened in a city by the name of Mashhad. Is it working? Are everything working correctly? All right. Something happened in a city by the name of Mashhad. There was a fairly sizable Jewish minority in that city among a Shiite Muslim nation. As you're aware, the modern nation of Iran is a nation whose state religion, central religion, is Shiite Islam. There are different versions of this story. I'll read you one of them. This is from a man by the name of Joseph Wolff. Joseph Wolff was a German-born British Jewish Christian missionary who actually visited this part of Iran. You can find a book written by him. Looks quite interesting. He went all over Asia trying to convert people. Apparently, he was kind of an unusual individual. He visited this town of Meshed or Mashhad twice. The second time he went after a certain event took place in 1844. Here's a quote from his book. All the Jews of Meshed, 100 families, were compelled 7 years ago to turn Muslims or Muslims. The occasion was as follows. A poor woman had a sore hand. A Muslim physician advised her to kill a dog and put her hand in the blood of it. She did so. When suddenly the whole population rose and they said they had done it in derision of their prophet. Prophet with a capital P, I think you know who that is. 35 Jews were killed in a few minutes. The rest, struck with terror, became Mohammedans, and the fanatic and covetous Mohammedans shouted, "Light of Muhammad has fallen upon them." Then Wolf goes on to say, "They are now more jealous Jews in secret than ever, but they call themselves Jews, like the Jews in Spain, Anusim, the compelled ones." Another account by the same author, Joseph Wolf. In the year of 1838, I think it was off by a year, according to the historical records, it was usually 1839, the Mohammedans celebrated the feast of Bayram. On that very day, a Jewess slaughtered a dog at the advice of a Mohammedan physician for the purpose of washing with the blood of the dog her own hands. One of the Muslim Saeeds who heard it and to whom the Jews previously had refused a present, read bribe, called together all the Muslims in the mosque of Imam Riza and addressed them in the following manner. Quote, "People of Muhammad and Ali, the Jews have derided our feast of Bayram by sacrificing on the very day of our feast a dog. I shall now tell you in two words what must be done. Allah dad, which means God has given." They took this allusion, and whilst the Asuf Udawla, the Mirza Eskari, the Imam Juma, and the rest of the authorities were sleeping, the whole population shouted, "Allah dad!" And with this shout of "Allah dad," they rushed into the houses of the Jews, slew 35 of them, robbed and plundered their property, and the rest of them saved their lives, but not their property, by reciting the Mohammedan creed. Only a few of them preferred death to apostasy. Mullah Dawood Cohen, the chief rabbi and high priest of the Jewish nation of Mashhad, gave the first example of apostasy. In other words, he turned away from his faith. The year in which this happened still goes by the name of Allah Dad among both Jews and Mohammedans. In secret, they observe the Jewish religion, and they tell their children not to forget the event of Allah Dad. It's an interesting story and an interesting example of religious persecution, but also particularly interesting to me because in actual fact, these were my people. When I go back to my grandparents' generation, my grandparents all lived in the city of Mashhad in the nation that's now often referred to as Iran. We always called it Persia. the Jews of Iran bit by bit got out. Iran at one point had about 250,000 Jews. The population of Jews in Iran is now much lower, I think somewhere in the region of 12 to 15,000. But anyway, when this event happened back in 1839, the Jews were given three choices, none of them very appealing. Number one, get out of town immediately. Often when these things happen, they were given 2 or 3 days to pack some belongings and get out. Number two, convert. Give up your own religion and convert to Islam. Choice number three, to die. Now, in actual fact, most of my people, and this goes back about 3, 4, even 5 generations now, most of my people actually succeeded in figuring out option number four. Option number four was to become crypto-Jews. Now, maybe you don't know what that means. A crypto-Jew is the same thing as what the Jews of Spain did in 1492. If you lived in Spain in 1492 and you were told essentially the same three options, convert, get out, or die, what many chose to do was to pretend to be Catholics. They were Catholics on the surface and they kept the Jewish religion as much as they were able to do in their homes. The Jews of Persia did something very similar. They became crypto-Jews. They went to the mosque, they recited the Islamic prayers, but they also very quietly kept prayer groups and kept sort of family synagogues going in their homes. They were crypto-Jews, secret Jews. As the years went by, sometimes the neighbors got to figure out who they were. Sometimes they didn't really know. Sometimes it was very well hidden, because not to hide it could have had a very, very high cost. I read a book recently. It's called Jadid al-Islam. Al-Islam to the Islamic faith. Jadid in Farsi means new. These were the ones who were new to Islam. There'd suddenly been an influx of people who became Muslims. They were Jadid al-Islam. In actual fact, they were Jews. But they had to kind of go underground. And they developed certain stratagems for defending their own faith. Many of them had shops. They couldn't get into government work or to the professional guilds. And so many of them were tradespeople and they had shops. And if you closed your shop on the Sabbath, why, that was much too dangerous. So the shop had to remain open. But they developed a certain stratagem. One member of the family would sit there at the counter of the shop, and if anyone from the populace came in and wanted to purchase something, they pushed the price up so high that there was no trading. The Muslims believed that the Jews would cause them to be ceremonially unclean. When it rained heavily, they forced the Jews to cross by on the other side of the street. There were occasional acts of violence. I used to hear bits and pieces of this in the home of my grandparents as I was brought up in London, England. And as I say, most of them were still there until the generation of my grandparents. That particular image that you can see is actually an image of the Jews of Tehran, which is the capital of Iran. And I think there is still a synagogue there. I can remember, I'll add a couple of details before getting into the substance of the sermon. I remember having cousins, distant cousins, and I remember, I think more than one of them had the name Haji. Think about this for a moment. Haji, strange name for a Jewish man, no? What is the Hajj? The Hajj is the obligatory pilgrimage that an Islamic man must make to one of the holy sites of Islam. And once you do that, your name may legitimately be Haji. I had a couple of cousins whose names were Haji. They adopted that name in an attempt to prove that they had done their Islamic responsibility. I also remember letters coming from people in the old country. I wish I kept a couple of them. Some of those old letters, and I remember my grandparents saying, this letter is written in Jadidi. Jadid, remember, means new. What they actually did, they would write with Hebrew alphabet and Farsi words. They combined it that way. My mother was one of many, and as a result, she was actually born in England. She was not born in Iran, but she was born in England. As a result of that, I've got cousins in many, many parts of the world, many parts of the world. Now, the reason I'm going through all of this is because this kind of incident, which has not been that uncommon in human history, this kind of religious persecution is something that most of us in this room have never had to face. We've never faced that kind of a thing. We don't know how it feels. Now, I know this is East Texas, and some of you have been told you ought to attend a particular church on a Sunday morning to get in with the in crowd in the community, right? At least I'm told that's the kind of thing that happens here. But it's not quite the same as being told you convert or you die. We don't really know how it feels. This is my adopted nation, and I still marvel at the beauty of the religious freedoms that people have in the United States of America. Sometimes we don't realize just how valuable those religious freedoms are. You ever stop to ask yourself whether the Church of God could have accomplished what it accomplished in the 20th century and in the early 21st century had it been based in another country other than the United States of America? I submit far less would have been accomplished, much, much less, given the combination of prosperity and religious freedom, with all those people back then coming over from Europe and saying, if there's one thing we don't want a state religion. State religions have been the norm through most of human history. No separation of church and state in medieval Europe, no separation of mosque and state throughout the Islamic world to this day. So what I'd like to do in the sermon this afternoon is talk about, and Mr. Trotter made reference to this in the sermonette, something that will come before the return of Jesus Christ. We know from the Bible that there's going to be a time of religious persecution. We know it's going to be a very, very difficult time. We know that even we in the Church of God, and we know that our God is a God who cares about us and looks after us and protects us, we know all of those things, but we also know from the scriptures that we're not going to get off without being impacted by these events. The title is The Mark of the Beast. What is it? How does it come about? Where will it come from? And what is our hope? Let's begin in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, and get a little bit of rather important background on this. Everything I'm going to say in the sermon today has been the doctrine of the church for decades, but I think sometimes we need a little bit of a reminder. Daniel 7, beginning in verse 23. Daniel 7, verse 23. Daniel sees this famous vision of four beasts. In Daniel chapter 2, it was an image. In Daniel chapter 7, it's four beasts. And he struggles to describe the fourth one. Daniel 7, verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. This fourth beast is aggressive. It tramples on people. It smashes the remnants of the previous empires. Verse 24, the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them, different from the first ones, and he shall subdue 3 kings. So 3 get subdued, and then we're left with 7. He shall speak pompous words. He's full of his own ego. Pompous words against the Most High. He shall persecute the saints of the Most High, that's you and me, and shall intend to change times and law. Now, a lot could be said about that, but I think we understand that reference in verse 25. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. It's a little bit confusing. We need to note that in both Hebrew and in Greek, there is a singular and there is a plural, but there is also a dual. So where it says time, times, and half a time, some of the Bible translations translate it for a time, two times, and half a time. In other words, 3.5 prophetic years. So this kingdom, and it's not named here, nor is it actually named explicitly in the book of Revelation, but this kingdom, the fourth kingdom, and we know its identity, and many Bible commentators know the identity, that this is the Roman Empire, the empire that has brought such difficulty and tribulation for the people of God down through the centuries. All right, so now, who or what is the beast? Who is the beast? I'm going to spend most of the remainder of the sermon in the book of Revelation. And one thing to be reminded of, and I think it's an important reminder, is that this name in the book of Revelation is a name both for the empire and also for the individual. There will be an individual on the world scene whom the book of Revelation describes as the beast, and one person. We don't know the identity of that person yet. It's also the name of the empire, this empire that will arise prior to the return of Jesus Christ. Turn with me, please, to Revelation chapter 19. Go forward into the New Testament now. Revelation 19, verses 19 and 20. Revelation 19, verses 19 and 20. Where the Apostle John tells us, Revelation 19, verse 19, "And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gather together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army." The one seated on the horse, of course, is Jesus Christ, our Lord, our leader. "Then the beast was captured, one individual, and with him the false prophet." They work together. There's a political military leader. There's going to be a religious leader who worked signs in his presence, the signs of miracles, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. So the two, the false prophet and the beast, who will work together for a period of time, get cast alive into the lake of fire. This will rise up then in defiance against Jesus Christ. But in here in Revelation chapter 19, the beast is one person, one individual. Who is that? We don't know. Now, some of you have been around the church, and I know here in East Texas, many of you have quite a bit of history in the Church of God. I came into contact with the church quite a while ago, in my teenage years in England, and we speculated a lot about who this might be. I won't ask for a show of hands. I'm guessing some of you have had long enough in the church to remember. Do you remember the speculation about Tito? Marshal Josip Broz Tito of Yugoslavia. In some of the very early publications of the church, it was speculated, maybe he's the beast. Keep your eye on him. Watch Tito. Some of you may remember that. This is interesting. Watch Tito. I watched him. He died. He was not the beast. He died in 1980, and sadly, this nation that he presided over, which was kind of a patchwork of different nations, then descended into some terribly bloody wars. You may have heard of another one. Some people thought that an individual, a Bavarian politician, you remember that one, Franz Josef Strauss, no longer living either. Franz Josef Strauss was a politician from Germany, very much an advocate of European unity. I was reading a little bit about him this week in my office. Very much wanted Europe to come back together and to have an influence on world history. He was an advocate of European unity. You know, he actually visited Ambassador College. Some of you know that. He visited Ambassador College, I think it was back in the early 70s. And he was quoted as saying, "We need an Ambassador College in Germany." And so, you know, at the time people were saying, well, maybe Strauss is the beast because he advocated European unity. But he actually had a friendship with Herbert W. Armstrong and was very impressed with all of that. And then, of course, he died. Franz Josef Strauss was not the beast. We don't know who it'll be. But if we have our eyes open, it should be easy enough for us to identify when that individual comes onto the scene. So we don't know the identity of the individual named the beast, but we actually do know quite a lot about the system and about the empire. And we need to be reminded of this. Let's go to Revelation 13. Revelation chapter 13. For those who are note takers, I'm going to spend most of the remainder of the sermon in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 because there's a lot here. I think I should like to preface this. You know, I teach a lot of the Old Testament prophecy at Foundation Institute, and I'm one who believes that we don't know every last detail about prophecy. There are things that we don't understand. I think, you know, as you go through life, you learn more about the things that you don't understand. You realize there's a lot you don't know. Back in the 1950s, the church was a little bit more dogmatic. We're a little more cautious these days. But there are some things that we do know. And there are some things that are pretty explicit in the Bible, and especially in the book of Revelation, about this last great empire that will govern the world prior to the return of Jesus Christ. Revelation 13 and verse 10, and verse 1, excuse me. Revelation 13, verse 1. "Then I," John says, "I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns." Reminds us of what we just read back in Daniel 7. "And on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name." He is a blasphemous beast. He's 10 nations, we've said 10 groups of nations. Again, we don't know for certain, but that number 10 is significant. Verse 2. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, moved quickly. Feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So we know where the power behind this beast empire will come from. It will come from the dragon, from Satan the devil. There's a comparison with the animals here. Now again, I think I want to draw our attention to, in the sermon, to Europe in particular, because this is an area where our attention needs to be focused. Things are actually happening in Europe now that are kind of under the radar screen of much American foreign policy, and I fear under the radar screen for many of the people in the churches of God. But let's keep on reading. Verse 3. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. 476 AD, the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. People thought this was it, but he kept on coming back to life. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Verse 4. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? They worshipped the beast, the individual, the empire, and the dragon, the spiritual power behind the beast. And so as we come through all of this, one of the questions that we're going to have to ask ourselves is, why is it that we as God's people are forbidden to enter into this system? What is it about it? Well, we've already read it and we'll keep on reading this. It's about worship. You and I know that we worship only God. We worship God the Father. Jesus Christ is our Lord and our Savior. We worship God, and to worship anyone or anything other than God is forbidden by him. And here we've got this situation where they're worshiping Satan the devil, the dragon, and the beast. And they're marveling. He's so powerful. When you look back into the prophecies of the Old Testament, Ezekiel talks about Tyre and he talks about Egypt in a very similar ways. Because when you've got a huge power on the world scene, you know, the schoolyard bully, this is what you've got. And everybody wants to be in with him. So we're reading something very similar here. Nobody can defy him, surely not. Verse 5. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. He blasphemed, like we read in Daniel 7. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now, the duration of all of this is emphasized in the Bible a number of times. 42 months, of course, is 3.5 years. One of the reasons that that duration is given is for you and me, so that those of the saints who are alive and see that know this isn't going to last all that long. It goes for 3.5 years. It will be miserable, but it comes to an end 3.5 years later. Verse 6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. He raises his fist against God and blasphemes in defiance. The tabernacle of God there may well be a reference to the church. Those who dwell in heaven, Jesus Christ, the angels of God's throne. Verse 7, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe and tongue and nation. And I've always found it interesting, the way it's phrased here. Look at what it says in verse 7. It was granted to him. Isn't it interesting? It's in the passive voice. It doesn't just say he had the power to make war against the saints. It says it was granted to him. It came from a spiritual level. Now, we know from other scriptures, like the book of Job, you remember, that Satan the devil has power, great power actually, very great power. But God is of much greater power than him. God is always is in higher power. He's in control of the spirit world. And so that wording is very telling. Authority was given him over every tribe and tongue and nation. Big, big empire. Verse 8. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. So, you know, if you go to Europe these days and you talk to many of the people in Europe, Europe is not, the United States has gone down a secular path, it's true, but not nearly as far as Europe. You talk to people in France and Italy and Germany and so on, and the knowledge of the Bible is negligible. And so it's really not surprising. And you know, when I travel around in the south of the United States, I'm still impressed by how biblical, even to this day, the south of this country still is. I think sometimes in the church we underestimate that. To this day, I know it's slowly ebbing, I understand that, but it's still there. It's still there. Well, all you've got to do is drive along Highway 80 and see how many churches there are along Highway 80. There's a very immediate proof of that. Anyway, the point here being that everyone will worship him except those whose names are written in the Book of Life. And we hope, of course, and believe that that is you and me. So, we've got attention to commandment number two, no idols. Why is it forbidden for you and me to participate in this? Because God says, don't worship idols. But let's keep on reading. Verse 10. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. The saints of God sometimes have to sit tight and exercise patience and exercise faith. And there's another little word of encouragement. It's interesting. In the book of Revelation, where we read about this very difficult, very troubled, very dark time to come, but we get these constant little bits of encouragement. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. If you lead into captivity, you go into captivity. If you kill with the sword, you will be killed with the sword. That's what's going to be the outcome, the end of all of these events. Let's read verse 11. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. The voice was not the voice of the lamb, masqueraded as a lamb. Now, it's not hard to figure this one out, is it? This is the religious entity, and the religious entity and the military political entity are going to work together. In actual fact, historically, what happened was that the religious entity fingered them, so to speak, and then the political military entity went after them and persecuted them in medieval Europe. It has the voice of the dragon. In John chapter 10, we won't turn there, but in John chapter 10, Jesus says, my sheep hear my voice. We've become good at that, I hope. We recognize the voice of the lamb. We recognize that voice. It's sometimes an instinctual thing to recognizing truth. Yes, we should, of course, sit down with our Bibles at home and study the Bible and look closely at what it says. But sometimes you hear something. You ever had this experience? And you said, it doesn't sound quite right to me. It doesn't sound right. Well, at this point, God's people will be saying, no, this doesn't sound right. Verse 12. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. You've the religious power working in concert with the political military power and saying, you've got to worship him. And God's people will say, no, sorry, we can't do that. Verse 13, he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Keep on forgetting about the PowerPoint. That image is actually from, getting a little ahead of myself, that image is actually from our booklet. I think it's an iStock image. He performs signs. Now, in the book of Revelation, in John's writings, the word signs means miracles. And so the interesting thing to note here in verse 13 is that this great power, this Antichrist power of the last days, will be allowed to work miracles. Again, I think when you talk to people who are not biblically literate, it's not that surprising that many of them will say, if he can do things like that, he must be of God. I mean, people are going to say that. Now, we don't have to turn back there. We won't take the time to turn back there. But in Deuteronomy chapter 13, in Deuteronomy 13, where God through Moses gave a test for true prophets, one of the things that that particular passage admits implicitly is that, yes, from time to time, a false prophet will be able to work miracles. That may happen, and it will happen in the last days. The working of miracles is not, of and by itself, the ultimate proof that someone is a man or a woman or a prophet of God. He performs great signs. He makes fire come down from heaven. Wow, if he does that, must be a man of God. How else could that be? in the sight of men. Now, it's worth thinking about here, because at the same time, and we're not going to turn to Revelation 11, but in Revelation 11, it talks about two true prophets of God who come on the scene. And again, we don't know the identities of those two, but they are, will be, true prophets of God, and they will be working miracles at the same time. So, you know, I think a lot of people on the scene at that point are going to be shaking their heads, looking here and looking there and saying, whoa, whom should I believe? The two witnesses in Revelation 11. Verse 14. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and who lived. Deception is going to take place. Matthew 24, verse 24. Please keep your place in Revelation 13. Matthew 24 and verse 24. Matthew 24, verse 24. I always used to wonder about this verse when I first came into the church and studied at Ambassador College. Matthew 24, verse 24. False Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. If possible. The old King James Version here used to have, if it were possible, with the subjunctive, with the hint that it's not possible. But the New King James has it a little closer to the Greek, if possible. Let's make sure that it's not possible, that you and I can't be deceived. And then verse 15, back in Revelation 13, verse 15. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. Traditionally, we've understood this as being a reference to the papacy, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So you've got to worship this image of the beast. Verse 16. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. There she is, that woman in my slide. I'm not a believer in death by PowerPoint, by the way. I've never been much of a PowerPoint fan, but I thought for the purposes of this one, there were some things I wanted to bring out, and that's in our literature. You may have seen that, the woman with the coat on her forehead. We'll get to that in just a moment. All right, so here in verse 16, we read about the mark on the right hand and on the forehead. What is the mark? People are always fascinated by what is the mark. There's a Greek word used here, and the Greek word is charagma. Charagma, C-H-A-R-A-G-M-A, charagma. And it's only used in the book of Revelation, interestingly. What is it? We don't know exactly. We're told that it is going to be on the forehead and on the right hand and on the forehead. Maybe some kind of a branding. Maybe something like the tattoos that they used to put on the concentration camp victims in the Second World War. I'll give you another reference. It's actually not in the Bible. It's in one of the apocryphal books, which are, you may have a Bible back home, or you may even have a Bible with the Apocrypha with it now. The Apocrypha, of course, are not part of the Word of God, but sometimes they include details which are interesting. This is from 3 Maccabees 2 and verse 29. 3 Maccabees 2 and verse 29. It's about Ptolemy, the king of the south, the dude from Egypt. Those who are registered are also to be branded on their bodies by fire with the ivy leaf symbol of Dionysius. This is one of the Greek gods, and they should be reduced to their former limited status. Branded is the same word. It's in that apocryphal book. So some kind of a brand. Will it be some kind of a biometric of some kind? A chip? Any of you read in the news this week about pigs with chips implanted inside of them? I found that was kind of interesting. I don't know. I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to the technology. It took me a long time even to get a cell phone like everyone else. I don't think we can eliminate the possibility. There may be some kind of technological angle to this. But a credit card, a chip or something. But I think it's worth our keeping in mind that the Bible draws our attention to the spiritual angle on this and not to identifying exactly what the mark will look like. I think we'll know. I think we'll know when this takes place. It will be something that will actually lock you out of the economic system if you don't accept it. Let's keep on reading. Verse 16, he causes both all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive the mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, verse 17, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So, yes, this is going to be a time of very, very great trial for God's people. Why? Because you get locked out of the economic system if you won't participate in it. Interesting the way it describes here. Now, it mentions here the three elements here. The mark is one. You have to have the mark, whatever it is, or his name. Now, I'll speculate a little bit here. Will this mean a personal acquaintance with the beast, somebody who knows someone? You know, people have done this down through history. I know this person, therefore they give me a special perk or an economic opportunity, or the number of his name. The number is given in verse 18. Verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Now, of course, God's number, as we know, is 7. The number of humanity is number 6. His number is 666. Well, who is it? Which man is it? Who's it going to be? People are fascinated with this kind of thing. And again, we've made an association, I think correctly, with the Roman system. The Roman system, someone who comes out of the Roman system, all of the Greek letters have numeric values. And so if you take names of certain individuals and you calculate the numeric value, you can come up with a certain number. Many years ago, I sat down with pencil and paper and tried playing with this. And I think, if I remember correctly, I succeeded in getting Fidel Castro to come up as 666. It is not Fidel Castro. This is something associated with the Roman system, very likely. And again, we're fascinated by what does the mark look like and what about this number. But the scriptures draw our attention to the spiritual angle of this. Now, let's stop and think for just one moment here. The economic system described here in Revelation chapter 13 is not like the economic system that we have in the United States or Canada or Western Europe at present. This is obviously what's called a command economy. Whoever this is will tell people, you're in or you're out, if you will worship the beast. You're in or you're out, and then they're going to be told what to do. This is not a kind of a free-moving capitalist economy. It's a command economy of some variety, where this empire takes charge of certain things, and if you don't cooperate with it, then you get locked out. The other point here to note is we're warned about this because of the worship of the beast and the worship of the dragon, which is a violation of commandment number 2, but almost certainly, I think, also commandment number 4 is involved here. We've said this for decades. I think it's still true. The text doesn't say this is imposed Sunday keeping and the exclusion of Sabbath keeping people, but I think it's a pretty safe inference that those who become involved in it are going to be guilty of violating commandment number 2 against idols and commandment number 4. Whatever the case, as God's people, we read this, and the warning here is, don't go near this thing. Don't go near. Now, let's keep our place here. Hold, before we go to the book of Deuteronomy, I want to go to the book of Deuteronomy, but something to take note of here. I mentioned this is a command economy. We're in a really tough time this year, as you know. This virus that has come not just on the U.S., but on most of the world, has had a huge impact. It hardly needs to be emphasized. One of the things that I think we should keep our eyes on is the solution that has been brought out for the virus, the economic solution, which I think you know, which is for the federal government to inject enormous amounts of money into the economy. You know what the deficit was prior to the pandemic? Prior to the pandemic, the federal deficit was about $1 trillion per year. That's before the pandemic erupted in late February and early March. It's much higher than that now. Prior to the pandemic, it was, and let me bring it down to the level of an individual budget or a household budget, it was earning 80 and spending 100. That's where it was before the pandemic. I don't know what the numbers are now, but I read this week, the Congressional Budget Office is predicting a deficit of about $3.7 trillion this year. And they're also predicting that this year, 2020, the national debt will eclipse the annual economic output of the United States, with the ratio of federal debt to GDP rising to 101%. That's the first time that the national debt eclipses the economic output more than 100% since the Second World War. That, I think, is unsustainable long run. So one of the things for us to keep our eyes on is what goes on in the economy, a very serious matter of the national deficit. Now, let's come back to that in just a minute. Keep your place here in the book of Revelation. We'll come to Revelation 17 shortly, and let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. We just read about this mark on the forehead, on the hand. How many of you have ever seen that? That may be familiar to you. This is religious Jewish men praying, and they're wearing their prayer shawls, and they're also wearing their, these are referred to as in Hebrew as tefillin, on the forehead and on the arm. The New Testament refers to these as phylacteries. Putting on your phylacteries or your tefillin, if you are a good Jewish man, you're supposed to do it every day of the week, actually except for the Sabbath. And it's like a little leather box with leather straps tied behind it. And the leather box goes here, just below the hairline. It's a little leather box, and it's got a little parchment inside of it with some scriptures inside of it. And then on the left hand, let's get this right, on the left arm, there is another leather box, and it goes on the bicep. In other words, this is designed to demonstrate the fact I subject myself to God's law in what I think and what I do. Now take a look at Deuteronomy 6 and verses 6 through 9. Deuteronomy 6 verse 6 says, "These words which I command you today shall be in your heart," Moses says. "Teach them diligently to your children. Talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up." I think that's an important thing for us to do when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles. Some of our conversation needs to be about spiritual matters. We are going there, after all, for a spiritual purpose. And then verse 8, "You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlet," letotafot in the Hebrew, "between your eyes." So the way that the modern Jews have interpreted this is with these leather boxes referred to as phylacteries, one of which you put right here, and the other one goes on the arm. And then verse 9, "Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." If you've ever been into the home of a religious Jewish person, you may have noted the mezuzah on the doorpost. It's a little cylinder, also with a little text inside of it, and religious Jews will kiss their fingers and then transfer the kiss onto the mezuzah as they go in. Deuteronomy 11 verse 18. Deuteronomy 11 and verse 18. Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verse 18. Again, Moses says, inspired of God, "Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes." Phylacteries, tefillin. So when we refer back to the book of Deuteronomy, it becomes very clear that what we read about in Revelation 13 is the opposite of this. This symbolizes rebellion against God, just as having God's word on your forehead and on your arm symbolizes submission to God. As I mentioned a moment ago, the deficits, not just of the United States, but of all of the countries of the world, China, Western Europe, have really spiraled with all of this. And I wonder, and yes, I'm speculating a little bit, but I wonder whether this enormous uptick in the deficits in the world economy will eventually lead to what we read in Revelation chapter 13. Proverbs 22, verse 7. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." You go into enormous debt and you become very, very vulnerable. The borrower is servant to the lender. Former Vice President Dick Cheney famously said, deficits don't matter. I think he's going to be proved wrong. So we just read Revelation 13, and what have we read about it? We've read about a time of huge trial that will come for the people of God because you're locked out of the system if you're not willing to bow the knee before this system. We've also read, and we'll read more about this shortly, that this is something that will come from outside of the United States of America. This is very important for us to understand, brethren. Looking at some of the talk on social media, it appears that too many people have forgotten this. This mark, this system, comes from Europe. And that really will be a loss of our religious freedoms in ways that most of us have never even experienced in our entire lives. The other thing I think that we need to take note of here, and going back to the matter of the economy, those of us who travel a lot, who go outside of this country, understand something, that the currency of this nation is still the reserve currency of the world. Mr. Hammer is aware of this. You travel to parts of Asia and people want dollars. You travel to parts of Latin America and people want dollars. The euro never quite took off the way it was expected it would. And the Chinese currency is not fully convertible. In fact, there's one little nation in Latin America that doesn't even have its own currency. El Salvador, its national currency is the dollar. You use your dollars when you visit El Salvador. The dollar is still the reserve currency of the world. When these events take place, the dollar will have ceased to be the reserve currency of the world. I think we can say that with certainty. And that will mean big changes. Revelation 17. Let's turn to Revelation 17, the other chapter where there is a lot said about this beast empire to come on the world prior to the return of Jesus Christ. Revelation 17 and verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I'm going to show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. A very uncomplimentary word to apply to a woman. Now, of course, the woman here is a woman in a symbolic sense. The Church of God is described as a woman elsewhere. Paul says, I wanted to present you to Jesus Christ as a chaste virgin. This is not a chaste virgin. This is the harlot, the prostitute, who has prostituted herself with religious and political matters. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. That's the image of the dogs. I want to get to that next one. With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. I had a church member ask me recently, what does this mean, fornication? It's kind of mingling with religious and political machinations, trying to get ahead. Spiritual entity that's referred to here has sometimes been referred to as a spiritual entity, a church that behaves as if it were a nation. Verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Here is the beast, and the woman is sitting on top of the beast, dominating the beast. Now, this coin is actually a euro coin from Greece. Much of Europe is now using the euro. There are 27 nations in the EU, the European Union, at present, of which 19 use the euro as their currency. This is a 1 euro coin. It's worth about $1.17, I think. And that's the Greek version. It looks the same from nation to nation, except for the lettering. And that's in Greek. And you can see the image there, I hope it's clear enough, of the woman, a woman sitting on the beast. Now, they think they just took this from their history. Actually, from Greek mythology, the woman is Europa, and the animal is the Greek god Zeus, the consort of Europa. Interestingly, when you go back into the history, it was Antiochus Epiphanes who placed a statue of Zeus Olympus in the Holy of Holies. And that's what the Bible refers to as the abomination of desolation. Now, let's keep on reading here. And verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hands a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Isn't that interesting? I recently also read the new booklet on prophecy. If you haven't done so, I would very much recommend it. But Mr. Lukey brings this out rather clearly, and I think he stated it pretty very well. Why does this refer to Babylon? If we're reading about a system based in Europe, based in Rome, why are there references to Babylon? And the answer is that the cultural and religious roots of this system are based in ancient Babylon. Verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. This was amazing. I was greatly amazed in the NRSV. So this is something we mustn't lose sight of. This is the persecuting power before the return of Christ. This is the power that will fight against Jesus Christ at his return. Verse 7, the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I'm going to tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. We shouldn't be marveling, brethren. We need to be able to recognize this. A crisis at some point in the future will lead to this revival of the Holy Roman Empire. And then verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. At one point it appeared to disappear from the world scene, and then it comes back and takes everyone by surprise. Not everyone. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel. They will be amazed in the NRSV. They will be astonished in the New International Version. Hopefully we will not marvel. It won't take us by surprise. Our attention's got to be directed in the right direction. Whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Verse 9. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. And now it begins to get pretty clear, doesn't it? Now, I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio for a number of years, I think about 10 years. And I learned that Cincinnati, Ohio is referred to the city built on 7 hills. But this is not talking about Cincinnati, Ohio, okay? I also learned recently that Lisbon, Portugal is a city built on 7 hills. It's not talking about Lisbon. No, this is talking about Rome. This is the Roman system that comes back to life before the return of Jesus Christ. And then verse 10. There are also 7 kings. 5 of those kings have fallen. 1 is and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. I've always been fascinated by that verse. 5 have come and gone, 1 is, which suggests that the understanding of Revelation 17 was given to the church, if you will, at a particular point in time in the second to last revival, the time of the Second World War. And there's 1 yet to come. When he comes, he must continue for a short time. Again, words of comfort for the church. It won't go on very long. Verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. It doesn't last long. 1 hour, of course, here is metaphorically. It's a short time. It won't last long. Verse 13, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Now, notice the way it's worded here in verse 13. Here we've got these 10 kings, and they yield up their power to the beast. It suggests that it's a time of crisis. Something has gone very wrong. Everybody is scared to death, and they look for a strong man. This is not democracy at work. The European Union at present has democratic institutions. Now, they work slowly. They're heavily bureaucratic. One of the reasons the Brits voted to leave the European Union was because it is so ponderous, and so that Brits felt that they were kind of disconnected from what goes on in Brussels. But nevertheless, if you talk to the officials of the European Union, they're going to say, yes, we've got democratic institutions. This is not democracy at work. This is a time of crisis. Economic crisis, political crisis, and they begin clamoring for a strong man. It's happened before. It will happen again. See it on the world scene today, though some of the strong men are not all that popular at present. That guy in Belarus, there's an attempt to overthrow him, but there are strong men elsewhere. China, Russia, Venezuela, sometimes not very popular. But there will be a strong man, and they're going to call out, we need somebody to save us. We are in a crisis. Verse 14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. It's amazing here. They make war against Jesus Christ. You know, when teaching classes at Foundation Institute, sometimes we go into some of the prophecies about the millennium in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and you've read them. Prophesy against Edom and say. Prophesy against Egypt and say. And I explained to the students in those passages that these are nations that Jesus Christ will impose his rule on once he's returned. And more than once I've had a student raise his or her hand and say, well, now, wait a second. I always understood that the millennium is a time of peace. And it is. But one of the first things, we're just reading about one of the first orders of business here, which will be that Jesus Christ, the Lamb, will have to put down an enormous rebellion. The millennium has already started, and he puts this down. But those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Verse 15, he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Eventually, the religious power will fall out of favor with the political and the military power. But prior to that, there will be this call for a strong man, and they'll work together. Hopefully, we will understand that, we'll identify that when it takes place. But to do that, we must see the prophetic events through the prism of biblical revelation. We must read about end time events through what the Bible says. A lot of ideas out there in the culture, brethren, a lot of ideas that have even encroached in the Church of God, that when you hold them up against the light of what the Word of God says, they're not right. And we need to be very careful that we understand these events properly. So what have we seen? What have we seen so far in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17? Number one, and I've got 4 points here, there's more to be said here, I think. Number one, at this point, Israelite domination of the world is over by then. Now, I'm using that word Israelite in the correct biblical sense. The world is still dominated by, to a very great extent, by the United States of America. The 19th century was the British century, Britain's imperial century. In the 20th century, the USA became the reluctant policeman. Reluctant, because the USA never really wanted to have an empire like the France and Britain and Germany wanted. Post-World War II until now. But that's going to come to an end. And it appears to be coming to an end at this point in time. Number two, the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. This country is able to exert economic pressures on other nations still because the dollar is the reserve currency. And, you know, if you get locked out of the banking system of the USA, it becomes very difficult to conduct business and commerce. That's going to come to an end. Number three, and I think this is important, our ability to do a work comes to an end at that point. These events that we're reading about here will have an impact not just on us individually in our households, but even on the work of the church. The church has been able to do what it's done through much of the 20th century into the early 21st century because of the reach and the influence and the prosperity of the United States of America. That looks very likely to be heavily impacted when these events take place. Number four, this power comes out of Europe. The beast power comes out of Europe. Now, I'd like to move on to another slide. Take a look at this for a moment. This is something that we should be keeping our eyes on. There are things taking place in Europe right now. And I can't read the lettering, but I think I know. This is the Bundestag in Germany as it is presently constituted. And something has happened in the last couple of years that should not escape our attention. From the Second World War forward, there were two big parties in Germany, the Social Democratic Party, center-left, and the Christian Democrats, center-right. And they often governed together in coalition. The extreme right, of course, smacks of Nazism. And it was kind of a political blasphemy, even to advocate political views from the extreme right. Now, if you look at that image, this is the Bundestag now, and over there on the right of the image, the light blue represents a relatively new political party that came into existence in 2013. My German's not very good. My Spanish is better than my German. Probably some of you speak better German than I. Auf für Deutschland, or something like that. The Alternative for Deutschland. Now, the black color block is the Christian Democrats. The red color block is the Social Democrats. And they're in a coalition government right now. And guess what? They both shrunk over the last few years. And it's been the extreme right that has grown. Now, I'm not saying that everybody in that particular party is an unreformed Nazi, but some of them are. But this is something for us to keep our eye on. This is changing in Germany. And again, this is something that is not really getting into the news very much in this country, and perhaps is not on our radar screen either, but it should be. Daniel chapter 2, as we begin to wrap this up, Daniel chapter 2, verses 41 through 43, Daniel 2, verse 41, this is the lower part of that image that Daniel interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think Nebuchadnezzar could fully have understood it. Daniel 2, verse 41, whereas you, Nebuchadnezzar, saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so shall the kingdom be partly strong and partly fragile. Now, this is a little bit speculative, but I think this is at least a very likely interpretation of this, that the iron represents Germanic nations of Europe and the clay represents Israelite nations in Europe, including perhaps France. France and Germany have been the center of the European project since right after the Second World War. Israel is referred to as clay elsewhere in the Bible. Verse 43, they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Again, it's not going to last that long because it doesn't stick together too terribly well. All right, what about the good news? What about the good news? Well, the good news, as we've already read, is that this is not going to last very long. It lasts for a time and times and half a time. World War II lasted for 7 years. This will last for 3.5 years, and it will signal the time of the return of Jesus Christ. Let's go to Revelation chapter 15 and verse 2. Revelation chapter 15 and verse 2. Revelation 15, verse 2. John says here, I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have the victory over the beast, some will gain victory over him and not submit to him, over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name. They stand on the sea of glass having harps of God. Some will gain a victory over this beast, in spite of the fact that it will be a time of huge trial for the people of God. Luke chapter 21 and verse 28. Luke 21 and verse 28. Luke 21, verse 28. Luke's version of the Olivet prophecy, Luke 21, verse 28. Now, when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. Watch, these things are going to take place, and you know the return of Jesus Christ is close. Luke 21, verse 35. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Someone contacted me recently. I posted that image of the woman with the emblem on her forehead from our own literature, and a man contacted me, actually from the western part of the country. He said to me, well, when do you think it's going to be? I said, I don't know. He said, well, he came back with the same question. When do you think? How long in the future is it? I don't know. Nobody can say. I do believe that God expects us to keep our eyes on what's going on and to watch things as they develop on the world scene. Things can happen very quickly. If there's one lesson we've learned this year, things can change very, very quickly. This time of trial will come on the people of God, but it will not last very long. So, as we look toward the full holy days, as we come to the Feast of Trumpets, a wonderful day, looking forward to the return of Jesus Christ, and then the Day of Atonement, an event that must take place so that there can be peace on earth, the removal of a very real malignant spiritual influence, and then going to the Feast of Tabernacles, and wherever we may be, wherever we go for the feast, it really is my hope and my prayer, brethren, that all of us will take these things seriously, realize that we do live in very serious times, but look forward to the time that comes after that, the glorious and wonderful time when Jesus Christ will come back. He's going to put down this power, as we just read in the book of Revelation. He'll put an end to it. He'll put it down, and he will institute God's wonderful kingdom on this earth. And we look forward to that time.